tonight on Arena. September 5, Bring Them Down in the Seat of the Sacred Figure, the movie's up for review. And Aaron Monaghan and Ailish O'Loughlin on their production of The Playboy of the Western World. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. Tonight on our film reviews, we bring you three films about people under extraordinary pressure, pressures of different kind. In Bring Them Down, filmed in County Wicklow, the harshness of farming life is exacerbated by sheep rustlers and a deep desire for vengeance. The terrorist attacks at the Munich Olympics of 1972 are at the centre of a new feature, September 5, which focuses on the journalists covering the running story and the ensuing moral dilemmas. And we'll review the Iranian feature, The Seed of the Sacred Fig, which was filmed in secret in Tehran and which is now nominated for an Oscar after its success at Cannes. Tara Brady, John Maguire are with me in studio. We'll start with Bring Them Down, Christopher Andrews' sheep farming revenge thriller set in the wilds of Connemara and in fact inspired by events in Cumbria, but shot in Ireland. Christopher Abbott and Barry Keoghan face off in this film, which boasts a Rashomon-style perspective shift. Tell us first of all about the Christopher Abbott character. The lone, I don't know if I'm right in saying lonely bachelor, but the bachelor farmer here looking after his dad, Colomini.
Colomini. They speak Irish together at home. Yeah. And Christopher Abbott is an American actor. He was the wolf in Wolfman a couple of weeks ago. Now he's the sheep farmer in Bring Them Down.
Oh, look what you did there.
I know. Yeah. Well, no, I'm going to keep doing that actually, Jean, because there's a lot to be said about this film. But anyway, he plays this lonely bachelor. There's an opening prologue that shows us why he's a lonely bachelor. He was in a relationship with Caroline, who's played by Nora Jane Noon.
In the older version, a little prologue.
Yeah. And there's a car accident. Nora Jane Noon's character gets an injury, a scar that she has to wear for the rest of the film, and Susan Lynch, who plays Christopher Abbott's mother, Michael's mother, as she dies in the accident. So there's a resentment between them.
You
see her for 30 seconds.
Yeah.
She gets three lines of dialogue in which she says, "I'm about to leave your father." And then we meet him, Ray. He's played by Colomini. They speak Irish together at home. Abbott does a really impressive turn as a Gaelgore. Have you a clip of
that? Yeah, I have a clip of him doing precisely that.
One of the best things about the film, Sean, is I have to say I was deeply impressed
by his facility with the Irish language. I mean, I don't know how much of it he understood. I got everything he was saying and the emotion of his playing. But there's no doubting that he'd be top of the class. But barring the runga.
He could do an Irish oral now.
He could probably in for the owl leaving cert. Here he is, talking to his dad, Colomini.
Ain't all, man.
Mall.
Well, so it's all mall.
Mála, I cared.
Cáir ólam dhá bácála.
Tón gáta cúl, fák áltse. Ná húla tú táda.
Né, ám ós cáir.
On Gatis Christa, August Tolorik Tardinian.
Well, if he may get to the Sun Radio. I told his father.
There's Colomini. And starts calling with Christopher McAbbott.
very good in that
scene from Bring Them Down. And there's no doubting. Like that performance, he has that kind of reticence of the mountainy sheep farmer within Christopher Abbott. So I thought his performance in particular across the entire movie carried an awful lot of the problems within the movie itself, Tara.
Look, well, Christopher Abbott's a really impressive actor. He's impressive in everything, and he's incredibly versatile. You know, and even Wolfman, which isn't a universally loved film, he's very convincing. I mean, he turns it into it's some kind of neurological disorder drama. Like, he really brings a heft to it that isn't normally there in a film
which
about
is a
wolf
bit more
men.
Believable than a fella becoming a wolf.
Yeah, a bit. And it's not. I mean, mean, my main problem with, I think, Abbott's performance, and I don't know if he's a Mac or an O, but like my main problem with him is that he's too young for the part. And there's a whole lot of mismatched kind of casting, I think, in the film. Nora Jane Noon is too young for her part.
She's his ex-girlfriend married to neighbour.
And there's supposed to be then kind of the suspicion that maybe he could be Barry Keoghan's father, and Barry then is too old for that. So you end up with these kind of...
But it's not clear. They're not... It's kind of... You pick that up. But
possible. That, yeah. But again, it's sort of, because everybody's the wrong age for the part, it really muddies the waters in terms of like how everyone relates to everyone else. And then when things slowly escalate and sheep go missing, and then we end up with this absolutely horrendous scene of animal abuse, which is the kind of dramatic centre of the film. There's nothing really to justify it, because, you know, everything else that's gone before it is so kind of murky.
Yeah, you get this sense that there is old...
They're living on either side of a mountain.
Yeah.
There is an old enmity between
enmity
them.
There, yeah. But even with the father, that's the Susan Lynch character at the beginning. I wanted to hear more. Why is she leaving the dad? I wanted more of that background and that family relationship. But Tara has touched on it there, John. The animal cruelty within, which is essential to the telling of the story, and I'm quite certain no animals were injured in the making of the film and all of the rest of that. Mm-hmm. But I thought the way that violence was handled, there's no glorification of it. And it deals with both the awfulness of these rustlers just cutting off sheep, ram's legs for no good reason.
Yeah, yeah.
For no good reason other than just destructiveness.
Well, that's what happens is...
And the gentleness of the Abbott character as the farmer who then must, give them the merciful death.
Yeah, yeah. It is a horrible scene.
But was the violence of that not played in a way that...
Well, it's the escalation of the violence in Abbott's character... because he's provoked by the other family into some kind of reaction. His reaction grows increasingly violent. Yes, there is violence against the sheep that he's... his own flock is... they have their legs cut off, and Keoghan's character and his cousin, who's played by... I can't remember the actor's name now, but he's very good in it, actually. And they hatched this scheme to make some money. But there's... The real violence to me is how Abbott's character turns into this killer, and he starts to kill everybody around him. There's a decapitation, there's multiple stabbings, there's all sorts of other violence.
The level
as well.
Of violence still jump. But then there's this.
It's the escalation is so badly mishandled
that
it comes out of nowhere.
Meek individual turns into this crazed killer.
Then he does Chris Andrews gives us this. I talked about the Rashomon style, so we get a kind of, suddenly there's a repeat of a scene, and you realise, oh, we're getting another version of the story here. Does that go any way towards kind of explaining what has happened?
No, well, I thought the Rashomon type structure was completely redundant, because I thought it just goes back over details that either we've already seen directly or we've inferred, but they're not enough of a revelation to justify. Yeah, whatever shift in perspective is there doesn't really tell us anything new.
It just feels
like a kind of a gimmicky thing that's there, but for no narrative purpose whatsoever.
And I think this came quite quickly. The making of this came quite quickly after Barry Keoghan had been in The Banshees of Inisherin.
Another film that deals with similar kind of themes about the country and the individual and the character.
But there was something restrained in his performance here that I thought it was good to see.
A little bit. I think he's under the influence of Aaron Heffernan is the actor's name, who plays his cousin. He's kind of druggy, kind of delinquent cousin, Lee, which is quite a good performance. And he's not so much learning how to farm livestock as he is trying to find some kind of an angle to get his father, who's played by Paul Reedy, out of debt. So there is a compulsion behind his character in and how he behaves, which is quite interesting. But it doesn't really go anywhere beyond the central scene where this entire flock is decimated.
Finally then, Tara, obviously structural problems and problems in the telling of the story for both of you, I think, here. Do the performances give us enough? And stars?
I like Paul Reedy and I like Colm. I actually preferred some of the kind of background players to the main. I just had a problem generally with the casting, and I never really got around that. And I just think the thing is so horrific and unpleasant, and I don't think it really justifies that horror. I don't think it has enough to say to justify it.
Stars?
So no more than two for me.
And what are you saying, John? Did the performances carry it for you?
As well, I like some of the performances here, but this is a deadeningly familiar film, and the bleak tone kind of eventually congeals into monotony. It becomes quite a boring watch. And there are some stirring performances, but there's no sense of place. And that's crucial to me when I'm watching an
Irish
film.
Irish did place it in the West.
The Gaeilge did, yeah. And they are attempting to frame it as a Connemara film. It doesn't look like any Connemara I've ever seen. And it is that slippy sense of place that they can't nail down. That's what I'd be looking for in a story like this, and it just wasn't there. So two for me, two stars.
Two from you as well. Okay, let us move on then to September 5. The terrorist attacks at the 1972 Munich Olympics have been explored many times on film, but in September 5, new film from German director Tim Felbaum, the perspective shifts away from those directly involved onto the sports journalist whose cameras are trained on the unfolding tragedy. Just remind us, Tara, of what was the unfolding tragedy at the 1972 Olympics and how these guys who were coming, you know, be the same as if I suddenly found myself in front of a football match. Not sure I would know what to do if I had a microphone in my hand.
So this is the 1972 Munich Olympic hostage crisis. And this is something we've seen it in film plenty of times before. One Day in September, which was a really excellent documentary from 2000, won the Oscar that year and is just a real banger, just absolutely moves at a clip and is really exciting, even as it moves towards a very tragic outcome. Of course, then Steven Spielberg's Munich as well is kind of the big blockbuster one. But so what this does is it focuses on the same crisis, but from a very, very small perspective, which is the control room of the Olympics. And it starts with them hearing gunfire across the way in the Olympic Village, because this is the ABC team. They're thinking about Mark Spitz and winning the swimming for the USA. And that's their main focus. And so this is completely left, as you can imagine, completely out of the blue for them. And as they realize that there's an unfolding crisis, and then that kind of slow drip feed of information, because it's 1972 and not everyone can just lift out their phone and see what's going on across the way. And they suddenly realize they're in a really serious situation where hostages
Israeli Olympic team
to be executed on an hourly basis. Their responsibility is to try and get cameras trained on it. And there's a whole bunch of negotiations around this, because they're sharing the same feed with other US networks to try and ensure that there's continuity in the broadcast. Yeah. And then all these kind of little analog things, like putting together the titles and all those kind of things. This is the kind of core of the film.
And back at home in America, who are the main players who are in Munich expecting to be covering the Olympics but find themselves covering this hostage crisis? First of all, John.
The broadcast crew, the recently appointed studio director, is Jeff Mason. He's played by John McGarrow. Ben Chaplin is his editor and his production manager, and he plays Marvin Bader. These are real characters. These are the real characters that were on the spot. And their chief, the guy who's responsible for the entire outside broadcast,
who'd be there as kind of head of sport or whatever.
The head of sport or whatever you'd call him, is Rune Arledge. He's played by Peter Sarsgaard, very well played by Peter Sarsgaard. They send out the cameras to investigate while they're trying to refuse the network's demand that they turn it over to the news department. The ABC want news to cover this, but they're the guys on the spot, the guys with the cameras and the guys with the information. And they also have a satellite link, which is fairly rare at the time. Novel for broadcast. So they're broadcasting live from the spot to American audiences.
And anything can happen in this situation.
And this is the thing, but up to this point, there had been terrorist attacks on sporting
and
events.
And two of the members of the team were killed, of the Olympic team were killed very early on.
Immediately, and there were 9 other hostages. But nobody had ever seen, nobody had ever watched a terrorist attack live on TV before, so this was going to be groundbreaking. So there is a moral dimension to this. There is a question of journalistic ethics, and there is also the pressures that are coming on them from the police, who turn up in the studio, telling them to shut everything down because the terrorists have TVs in the room. The Olympic villages, so they
villages can see,
so they can see what's happening as well. So that's the dilemma that they're in. And it's over 94 minutes this whole thing plays out. Well, you know, high not tension. In real time, but at high tension.
So Peter Skarsgård, as Rune Aldridge, then he has to make the shots or call the television shots. No absolute pun intended, obviously, at all there. John McGarrow, as Geoffrey Mason, he's kind of the technical side of things. He's in the control room. You know, what camera shot do you want here? What angle do you want? And then they've an editor in there as well. That third character that you mentioned there, played by Ben Chaplin. So let's have a listen to the three of them having a conversation about, well, how are we going to handle things that are happening live in front of the camera? What are we going to do?
5 minutes, everyone.
5 minutes. Take your positions.
Tower Cam, I want you to start with an establishing pan over the spectators and then push in. I want a gut punch close up of that terrorist.
Now, Jeff, can you turn it down a notch? It's not track and field. They threaten to kill people.
Is it a noon deadline confirmed?
Yeah.
What do I tell the cameras?
What do you mean?
I mean, can we show someone being shot on live television?
We can't control what happens.
No, wait. We're the only station going live with this, which means everyone will be watching us, including the hostages' families.
Okay.
All right, everyone, stay on your headsets.
You don't want anybody to see their kid executed on live television.
No.
So I don't know about the Israelis, but David Berger's folks are in Ohio. So I'm pretty sure they'll watch.
Well, someone should tell them not to watch it. But we have a bigger responsibility here.
What about the sponsors?
The sponsors are not going to be concerned. All they care about are viewers. Okay.
So is that what we're trying to achieve here? Is ratings?
No, we're following the story wherever it takes us.
All right, then let me.
That's Peter Sarsgaard as the kind of the chief book cat, the guy who has to make the production decisions. John McGarrow as the technical side. Oh, I'll start with the big pan. Well, maybe not that quite on this one. Maybe we should think different. And Ben Chaplin then, who's the editor, who's clearly at the heart of that moral dilemma. And it is a real dilemma they have. This is something that is world news and very important at the time. They are the only people who have pictures of it. But what do they do and what should they show and what should they not show?
Yeah, that is the real kind of interesting sort of meat of the thing. And also like the kind of discussions they have among themselves and trying to understand what's going on. Mm. And I think the drip feed's really important. And I think Leona Benesch's character, who's this makeshift German interpreter for them, was really brilliant in the Teacher's Lounge last year as well. And it's great to see her doing so well in an Anglophone like Hollywood role. But that slow feed is really good, and it keeps the narrative flow really good.
Broadcaster Jim McKay.
They use archive footage. That's very deftly done.
And that's really superb.
So you see what actually went out.
Exactly what he said. They didn't get a cast an actor to play him. They used the
good
original
idea.
Tape. Yeah. A really good idea. And throughout the film, Tara touched on it, there is the patience and there's a fascination for me with the process of how they're doing this, the whir of the tape reels, the tangle of cables, the weight of the cameras. They're trying to tap landlines. They're figuring out how to get into police frequencies. They do the title cards. It has to be painstakingly put out title by word by letter by letter. To me, that kind of solid state analog aspect of this production, while the clock
adds
is ticking.
To the tension.
And it adds to the tension. Exactly.
Stars from you, John.
This is a 4-star movie, Sean. I really like this. One of the moral questions aside for a moment, one of the most pressing issues faced by any journalist, and Tara backed me up on this, particularly somebody writing the same story over and over and over again, is to find an angle, to find a way in here. This film does that superbly.
Yeah, well, and would you hope when in the finding of that angle that you're not exploiting or,
Well, no, there's none of that. Yeah. I didn't get a sense of that at all. We know what happened, Tara, you see, and we find ourselves living the events again as if we don't know the outcome.
Two different
I love the journalistic procedural, but I don't think it's up there with something like All the President's Men, because I feel like they've decided to do it in a completely apolitical way, and just because you can doesn't and mean that you should
in the current environment.
Yeah. So, like, I mean, it's just below a four for me, maybe three and a half.
We don't get any political context.
It's strangely apolitical, yeah. Which slightly jarred with me.
All right, let's move on finally then to The Seed of the Sacred Fig. Tense drama set in Iran. We definitely get a political angle here, exploring the consequences of the ruling regime. They're through a close-knit family story which sees a father at loggerheads with his daughters, written and directed by Mohammed Rasoulouf. It has received critical acclaim since its release and its nomination for Best International Film at the Oscars next month. There was certainly, this wasn't a straightforward production, and Rasoulouf, I hope I'm saying that name correctly, he found himself in all kinds of trouble and had to be got out of Iran very quickly.
Well, he already has had a lot of trouble, and he's already served time in prisons. And in fact, the main character in this film is based on one of the guards that he encountered in prison, who was someone that he was talking to and who told him he feels really conflicted about his duties for the Revolutionary Court of Iran, and that he goes home and that his wife and his children are criticizing him for going along with certain things that he does in the course of his job. And that's very much the dilemma. So we have this Iman as the main character. He's promoted to being an investigative judge. His wife is delighted. So obviously more money is more prestige. And then there's the two daughters at home. But there's increasing unrest on the streets, and that in turn feeds into his paranoia.
Yeah.
And then somebody gives him a gun to protect himself, and then the gun goes missing. It's such a slow sort of descent into really, really major paranoia.
And you can see that, you can feel the tension even as you describe it there. But this is, I get back, we talked about the use of archive footage in terms of September 5. In the case of this, we have lots of telephone footage of,
from
again, because this is a real life, there was a real life event there at the heart of this story.
And it's interesting that one film depends on that solid state pre-digital technology and the other is predicated on the ubiquity of smartphones and camera phones. In 2022, mass protests erupted in Tehran and across Iran after the death in custody of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini, who had been arrested for not wearing her hijab properly by the morality police. Who subsequently killed her in custody. Rasoulouf was in prison at the time, actually, for propaganda against the regime for his 2020 film, There Is No Evil, which had won the Golden Bear at Berlin. And it was actually his third stretch in prison for the crime of being a filmmaker. So as the real-life protests intensified and the jails were overrun by the recently arrested, the government issued a general pardon and Rasoulouf was released. And that's where the kernel of this story came from. And when we're watching this, for me, very slightly soapy drama that, yes, it's tense and yes, it's paranoid, but it gets a little soapy for me. A family drama, most of which is played out in this little apartment in Tehran. Yeah. And out the window, we can hear, now and again, we hear the protests. And then Rasoulouf cuts to the real life camera footage of these most awful crimes committed by the state against the people that they're swearing to protect. And there's no denying, there's no hiding it, there's no getting away from it. That is the plain truth right in front of you.
And that's
and there's no counter argument to that. The rest of the film, everything is predicated on the fact that this government and this hierarchy, theocracy, really, are trying to put their foot on these people's necks, and the people are resisting.
And the other aspect of this is Rasoulouf directed this on FaceTime, on a virtual private network.
Yeah.
Everything had to be done secretly. Yeah. And the 13-minute standing ovation at Cannes, which, without belittling it, I'm sure as much as anything is for what he has managed to do in terms of filmmaking and exposing these stories as much as it was for the film. A summary and stars from you, Tara.
Well, you'd never imagine it was a guerrilla shoot. I think it's a really accomplished film. I think it takes that Iranian situation and it actually turns it into a really clever microcosm. And then the whole final act it turns into something completely different, like a really, really kind of exciting thriller, I would say 4.5. I think it's a really strong film.
And what are you saying, John?
It's a film about power and control and suppression and violence, but for me the story was slightly overextended. There are superb performances in this film, though. There's no absolutely no getting away from the core family. The four of them are absolutely superb. And the context of how the film was made, I think, is absolutely crucial to its appreciation. So it's not just about how it's what the film is about. It's how he went about it. So it's a four-star film.
Solid four, the
courage in it, Sean, in every frame of it, is extraordinary.
And even in the very making of it, obviously. Yeah. Thanks to Tara Brady and John Maguire there. Bring Them Down on September 5. We'll go on general release tomorrow. The Seed of the Sacred Fig will be in selected cinemas. Now, it might be hard to believe that some 120 years ago, the Playboy of the Western world, a play most of us have either seen or studied at Leaving Cert or Junior Cert, caused such ructions on its first production. In the Abbey Theatre, of course, in 1907, riots broke out at the opening performance of the play. Nationalists were outraged that the contents of the play, which seemed to make heroic the slaying of a father by a son, not to mind the rumour that females could be seen standing in their shifts on the very stage of the National Theatre. Such a fuss about a play about a mysterious traveller called Christy Mahon, who walks from Kerry to Mayo very short distance in Singh's mind because he says he has killed his father. Back in 2005, one of my next guests, Aaron Monaghan, played Christy Mahon, or the playboy himself, the young man who achieves a hero status in the Mayo village because of his claimed deeds. Now as artistic director of Live and Dread Theatre Company, he is producing his own version of Singh's masterpiece, which will go on a nationwide tour. And also with me is the woman who would have been standing in her shift in 1907. Don't know what she's wearing in 2025. Pegging Mike, who falls in love for Christy, and she is Ailish McLaughlin playing the character of Pegging Mike. Both very welcome. Great to have you with us in studio this evening. I mean, it's such a huge play in and of itself. In, you know, the Irish canon, it's there at the very centre of it, Aaron. But you have approached this from the playboy, Christy Mahon. That's a kind of a core role for any character actor to get his hands on.
Yeah, it's a gift. I remember at the time...
You played it, sorry, should I explain? When did you play it?
I played it in 2005 up until 2008 with Druid, the one of the many famous versions of Playboy that Druid have done.
Cillian Murphy had been in the production, I think.
Yeah, I think he'd been in it in 2004, and then I took over in Australia, and then we went on that year then to do the entire cycle of Singh's work, the Singh cycle. In 2005-2006.
Yeah, that period.
Yeah, so I remember somebody at the time saying it was the Irish Hamlet.
Yeah.
And I suppose there's something vainglorious about that. There's a little bit of truth in it, but not really. It's a gift of a part, but I think more than the part itself, I really fell in love with the play. I didn't quite understand how big a deal it is or how big a masterpiece it is.
Yeah. I guess having played Christy, you got to see the play from one perspective, but then to be playing in the Singh plays, the Druid Singh series of plays at the time, to see the play within the overall perspective of Singh's work must have given you a bigger view. A more panoramic view, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, that experience was incredibly immersive. We were all living down in Galway. And what was incredible, I know we started out with Riders to the Sea, and that was one of his earliest ones. The subtle differences in writing, you think it's the same writing, but it's not. You could see how, when you moved through the plays, how he was refining not only the writing itself, but the stage directions. And he wrote for such a very short period of time as well. He wrote plays such a short period of time and died tragically short. But, you know, the Playboy was certainly the masterpiece.
Yeah.
And it was a joy then to do it. But everything I've done, I was like, what was I, 25 doing that play? What a gift of it was to do it at that time. Everything I've done since has sort of been the foundation of everything we've done with Druid in terms of Casey, in terms of...
Because that was the first thing you had done with Druid, playing Christy Mahon.
It was. And it became the language of how I work, and the, certainly was the language of what Gary worked, but everything we've done since then, whether it's Murphy or Friel, you realise that they have tapped into
it's been informed
in some way.
Informed by and I suppose you could say, Eilish, to a certain extent, Pegging Mike is a similar type of character, you know, core character in terms of the play, but in terms of the Irish, I suppose when you get to later plays and you know, more contemporary players like Marina Carr, you're getting roles for women with even more bite in them, obviously, than that. But Pegging Mike, how does Singh write for women? How would you describe who she is? Because she's quite the character.
She is. She's absolutely incredible to play. She's such a iconic female Irish character. She has so much weight to her from the beginning of the play, and she's so gorgeous in the sense that what's really gorgeous to play about her is that when we meet her first, she has so much, she has these walls up around her, and she's very hardened, very practical, very pragmatic.
And she's betrothed to Sean Keogh.
She's not exactly, it wouldn't be
anybody's first choice, probably.
No.
God bless. Who's playing him in this?
Sorry to Colin Campbell.
The wonderful Colin Campbell.
Absolutely amazing. He's brilliant in it. But yeah, so there's an element there of like, she's kind of, when we meet her first, she's resigned to her fate, I suppose.
Which is that marriage
and this life of like monotony and kind of droll that is just, it's kind of eroding her a little bit. And then you have this man that comes
into her daddy's pub when she's working there, comes the bowl playboy.
He arrives in this place with this marvelous story that everyone becomes infatuated with. And I think what happens with Pegging is that she has all these walls up around her, and then she meets someone who kind of ignites something in her that she forgot was there, because as the play goes on, you realise she's a bit of a romantic, and she's a dreamer.
Yeah. Well, her last line in the play is the real, I suppose, assertion of that.
Yes.
And probably it's one of those lines that's often quoted.
Absolutely. We actually, the last show we did, there was a woman in the audience that
said the line with you, you might as well give us the exact line because I'll probably slightly mangle the quote. What is the exact quote?
The exact line is, "Oh my grief, I've lost him surely. I've lost the only playboy of the Western world. And I left a small gap in between, oh my grief, and I've lost him surely. And I just heard a little titter from the audience of, she turned to her friend and she was like, "I've lost him surely."
Just in case you'd forgotten.
She was going to remind you of it.
But that in and of itself, Erin, you know, as Eilish describes it to us, there, a wonderful description of the character. But the iconic nature of that final line is, you know, it's immortal and it has been misquoted, and I would have misquoted it. I'm glad I got you to do it. So when it came to the casting of it, your playboy this time around is Christy Mahon, is Nisha Dunbar playing Christy Mahon. That shift, Erin, and I know you've directed before and you've written before, so you know you're used to that shift of role within a production.
Sure.
But I mean, I'd love to say if I were doing it myself, I would avoid the. Now, can I just suggest might try? There was when I discovered, you know, that type of thing. I never played playboy, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean there probably. I think the cast would probably argue that there was a little bit of that. I think we have an amazing cast, and if I may kind of laud Eilish for a second, you're sometimes thinking about plays and you're waiting for an actor to come along. Mm. And I remember I'd worked with both Nisha.
Particularly in an iconic play like this.
Yeah. And like people who can play those iconic parts are few and far between. And I think I've been lucky enough to work with both Nisha and Eilish and Amelia Crowley, who plays the Widow Quinn in Cavalcaders.
And Garrett Lumbert there as the old man.
So we had a great experience in that. And I remember it was particularly, if it's okay to say, Eilish and embarrass you, but I remember seeing Eilish and going, "I just think she'd be an amazing Pegging." And that was a huge part of it. And casting around herself and Nisha. I think the cast had a difficult time with me, I think, because I was surprised at how much, how well I knew the play in terms of the rhythms and in terms the lines 20 years later are still there.
Like, and I guess what obviously being involved in a production, a Druid production of the Playboy, like they've done very, the Playboy was the play, one of the plays that launched Druid Theatre Company. And at the time, again, a hugely important production in terms of Irish theatre. But did the production that you were involved in, how much did you have to get that, you know, monkey off your shoulder to a certain extent?
I think it's an impossible monkey to get off your shoulder because they did it in 75. And I think I remember Gary saying that they did it in 75 sort of for the tourists. Mm. And they said, if we survive as a company, we must look at that play again. There might be something in it. They did it in 77. They reinvented it for Irish audiences in 82. I think they did the Playboy of the West Indies in the early 90s. And then obviously the Sing cycle between 2004 and 2008. So their mark is well and truly over it. So as opposed to avoiding it, there was part of me that embraced it. That I knew I wasn't going to go head to head or, you know, toe to toe with a very traditional version of it. I was more interested in how it spoke to Ireland of today and I suppose the Ireland that has existed between 1920s and 1980s particularly. That's what we found as a design team we were interested in. But
so are we in a specific time and in Ireland?
Yes, I suppose to my mind we certainly are.
Where are we? We're
not in 1906 necessarily.
Yeah.
We're you know, there's no mobile phones and there's no televisions. we're not in 2025 either. It feels like when we were coming at this, what spoke to me about the play, again, as a director this time, as opposed to an actor just playing the role, was that the play is about, you know, rebellion and it's about poverty. So I was kind of fascinated by different aspects of Ireland throughout the decades. So it's set anywhere between 1920 and 1950s in a very rural, remote spot. But there's little touches of the 80s there as well. It's somewhere between Christianity and paganism. Mm. Every line of the play is a contradiction between those two things.
And Eilish, it doesn't matter what you're wearing, or it doesn't matter if there's a television set up on the back of the pub saying it's 1980, or it doesn't matter if there is a mobile phone. We don't have those things. As Aaron is describing to me, it sounds as if that kind of mid-20th century kind of feel of Ireland. But outside of all of that, you still have to play those words of 1907 with some kind of contemporary relevance. How did you go about finding that aspect of Peggy and Mike that would speak to a modern young Irish woman?
I think, like, when you read Sing, so much of his language, it's definitely heightened to a certain extent, but still so much of it is some of the stuff you would still hear today. And I think it's very easy to tap into Sing's way of writing and his lyrical language, because I think there's a specificity to his words that almost like he creates the picture for the audience themselves. And like, I think the audience kind of do the work once they hear the language as well. And like when it comes to marrying the language with these characters are so, they're so gritty and salt of the earth that it's almost like this lyrical language kind of trips off the tongue for them because they're so immersed in the land. They're so immersed in the sea, the mountains and everything that it just kind of trips off. And
the other aspect of it, so you have this beautiful language, I mean, fairly harsh conditions that they're living in, hand to mouth type of existence. And the marriage with Sean Keogh is as much an economic necessity as it is anything else. Christy Mahon then, when he does come in, even though he may not be telling the entire truth or anything of the truth at all, what does he bring onto the stage? What does that character bring into Peggy and Mike's world for you?
This is like one of the most fun things to play, is that when he comes in, so the play starts is that she's alone in this house, this rural Ireland, and she's on her own. There's a lot out there that could possibly hurt her. So this man comes in that has done this very, I suppose, violent deed. So she's like, he can protect me. So that's kind of the first side of it. And then the other side is that she wants to squeeze all the juice out of this story. She wants to hear all about it. She wants to know. She is hungry for this information. But
so
then
true crime was interesting even back in 1907.
Yeah, definitely. And like, I think on the opposite side is that she has this view of him. He's done this deed to his father. But on the other hand, when he arrives in, she finds him so curious because he's very soft and he has like almost like just this softness to him that kind of disarms her. And then the thing that gets her in the end is that he has access to this really poetic language that I think is actually in like her soul as well.
Yes. And so, that's why she has such grief when he turns out not to be who.
Absolutely. It's like a loss of a dream, I think.
What about the rivalry between her and Widow Quinn, played by Emilia Crowley in this production?
Yes, yes. So we did loads of table work and talking about this as well. And one of the things that we had come to was that these women, these two women, Peggy and Widow Quinn, they are so alike. They are so alike to the point that they don't realise how alike they are and they bash off of each other. They just
wouldn't be the first friendship or relationship that was based on that type of not realising how alike people are.
Yeah, and I think the thing is that Widow Quinn, like they have such different tactics for attack. Like Widow Quinn will undercut and she'll be more sly. She'll be more, she'll be kind of more, what is it, slippery about it, and it's harder to pinpoint. Whereas Peggy will just go straight in, like she would blunt, honest,
and open, no matter what the cost.
Guns blazing. And I think the thing with like Widow Quinn is that if it frustrates Peggy then that she's that good at undercutting her and undermining her, and that's what gets her.
Yeah, and you've Emilia Crowley in the role here. Was that a dream casting for you again?
Absolutely. I mean, and I suppose the actors that we have are so thirsty. The appetite for what they do. You know, Eilish has described it really well. Emilia is so slippery, so evasive, and it's electric to watch how much fun she's having with the part and how she's able to. Eilish and Emilia are very close as well. They work together a lot, but she's able to rile her up. And you're just sitting back and just watching these
let
two
them
women.
At it.
You know, it's electric, yeah.
Well, I have to say, as you describe it, I mentioned John Olohan is in there. I see there was Michael James as well. Katrina Williams as Sarah, Tansy, Susan Brady, Maeve Maxwell, Honor Blake. Ciara Ivey, Jimmy Farrell, Sean T. O'Malley, Philly Cullen, Gerard Byrne. I think we mentioned all of the cast so that none of them feel left out in the process. Sounds like you're rediscovering new things in this play, and that's what makes it a classic, I suppose.
And we're having a ball, yes.
The Playboy of the Western World by J.M. Singh, directed by Aaron Monahan and starring Eilish McLaughlin as Peggy Mike, will be at the Drogheda Arts Centre in Drogheda tomorrow, the 7th of February, and on Saturday the 8th. Then it's at the it goes to the Backstage Theatre in Longford, Tuesday the 11th, Wednesday the 12th, and finishes at the McLally Theatre in Galway on Friday the 14th. And suitable, the McLally Theatre, given that it was he that played
Part, Old Mahon.
Yeah, the Old Mahon back in that original Druid production. And that is in the McLally Theatre in Galway on Friday the 14th and Saturday the 15th. Of February. Full details on livingdread.ie. Renowned pianist Ali Sarah Ott, celebrated for her bold interpretations and innovative approach to classical music, is set to make a highly anticipated appearance in Dublin, where she would perform the works of John Field, the Irish composer who many of us know was credited with pioneering the nocturne, but often overshadowed by his successors, particularly Frédéric Chopin. Ott, Alice, has long been an advocate for breaking traditional concert norms, from performing barefoot to blending classical repertoire with contemporary elements. She has continually pushed the boundaries of what a piano recital can be, and delighted to be joined by Alice Sarah Ott right now. And it is Alice, it is given that pronunciation, am I right, Alice?
Yes, hi, good evening. Yes, Alice is correct, yes.
Yeah, good. Good. Okay. Now, you'll hardly be surprised that we in Ireland are very keen to point out that it was John Field who invented the nocturne. Because I think if you asked many people outside of Ireland, they'd probably say, well, would that have been Chopin? Would Chopin have been the guy who gave us the nocturne? But no, it was John Field. And this, you freely admit in the liner notes to your current recording of the complete nocturnes of John Field. This was a very recent discovery. He is a recent discovery for you.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. It was during the second lockdown of the pandemic that the name was, of course, picked up the name John Field probably during my study years, but nobody around me played any of his music, nor was my teacher very much interested. So it was just this little knowledge, you know. I didn't even know when he had lived. And then during the pandemic, I looked up nocturnes on the internet, and I came across one of the very few existing recordings of the complete nocturnes. And then, you know, I started listening to this music, and although it was totally unknown to me, most of them sounded somewhat familiar and nostalgic, and I got totally obsessed and wanted to play those nocturnes, and that's how I discovered them for myself.
And you have done the complete recording, 18 nocturnes. I suppose there will be academics who will argue night and day and black is blue that some of these are nocturnes and some of them are not. But at a certain point, you obviously had some criteria for defining what these 18 nocturnes were. But Field didn't write them as a set. They were very much written as separate pieces, weren't they?
Yes, I mean, he wrote it through he didn't live a long life, but and it's actually interesting. I think when he wrote the very first nocturne, Frédéric Chopin was only 4 years old. But they have a very particular language, I think. But still, they are very, like, some of them, they sound more like a very virtuoso rondo than there are ones that resemble a little bit of a Mozart andante. So it's very versatile, but still it has a very, very, very profound and very, very particular language, these nocturnes.
You suggested to us two particular nocturnes, I beg your pardon, from the recent album. A lot of people will be very familiar with the Nocturne number 5. It's probably the best known, I think, of Field's nocturnes, certainly in this part of the world. But I'm interested as to why you wanted us to listen to Nocturne number 2 in C minor. And just maybe before we listen to a bit of it, you would tell us what you think we should be listening out for here.
So this one is in a minor key, so it has a little bit of a darker tone. And, you know, my mother is from Japan, and I grew up also listening, although I've never lived in Japan, I grew up listening to Japanese folk music and pop songs. And there's always something very subtle about it. They very often sing about an emotion, hint at something without naming it. And I really think that in this nocturne that comes to life too. So for me, it's like somehow I related to my mother's home country.
Well, let's have a listen to a little bit of your own recording then, Alice, of John Field's Nocturne number 2 in C minor. The opening section there of the Nocturne number 2 in C minor of John Field, as played by Ali Serraat, who will be playing that and others of Field's nocturnes in the National Concert Hall in the coming weeks. Interesting that that is in the key of C minor. And I was just looking at the programme for the concert where you're playing several of the field nocturnes interspersed with or I don't know, is it the Beethoven interspersed with the field or the field interspersed with the Beethoven? But C minor, obviously such an important key for Beethoven, Fifth Symphony, lots of other things that you can go to in terms of that key as well. What is the link for you between John Field and Beethoven? Because I know you wouldn't program a concert of the two of them together if you didn't believe there was a link.
Yes, I mean, so at the very beginning when I started thinking about a life program, I knew that maybe John Field is not a name enough to fill holes. So I thought about many other composers and I didn't want to go with the obvious choice that would have been Chopin. And while I was listening to the Nocturnes, the composer I thought the most about was actually Beethoven. And then I found out that they were contemporaries. And I thought it's nice to put together these two composers who lived at the same time. There is no proof that they have ever met, but they lived at the same time, both shaped music history. And while one of them became this immortal figure, and there's almost nobody who doesn't know Beethoven's music, while the other one has somehow vanished from our awareness. And there are surprising similarities, but of course also great differences. And I thought that makes a nice contrast and again, a nice balance.
I was also looking at some videos that, of yours that have been made with for other nocturnes that are on the album, and it struck me that you when you approach these nocturnes, I don't know if you've made videos for all of them, but there's one, I think it's number 14, where you're on this kind of outer space type of landscape behind you on the stage where you're playing. And then there's another one, I think it could be number 10 or number 2 or number 10. I'm open to correction on this one, maybe number 9. Where you're in this glacial landscape, a kind of a winter landscape with the piano, the black piano in the midst of the white landscape all around it. Do you think of music in those terms, in very visual terms, in very, because they're almost like characters then, and you're like a character in the midst of this piece.
So we've filmed all these music videos in an immersive LED studio. So it's not real.
I didn't think you went to outer space. I didn't think you went there to
Well, I mean, I got some comments by people who have watched it and they were worried about my health and the piano's condition. But no, so we did it in LED space. And I mean, I worked together with Andrew Staples, who's not only a wonderful tenor, but also an incredible filmographer. And we started with moods. And so you, like, especially in this, it is the Nocturne number 9 in the Icy World. To me, it's almost like you are on a frozen lake and there's a snowstorm going around you. And underneath, there's another dimension that you cannot see. And that is dark and warm. So we wanted to recreate this world. And I mean, I love the possibilities that we have today, and to be able to use this technology to enhance the experience was a great experience and journey for me. And also, like, Nocturne number 2 is in a neon world, and I've always wanted to be in a video game setting. So this was kind of a dream come true for me.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask you briefly about a diagnosis you had, I think it was in 2019, of MS. Clearly, from what I've been watching on video and what I've been listening to on CD, thankfully that diagnosis has not affected your playing. It doesn't seem to have done to me at any, but it must have been a very frightening diagnosis to get. And how did you come out of that into the situation where you're playing at the same professional level today as you were before the diagnosis?
So, of course, at that time, it was a very frightening diagnosis, especially when I didn't know much about it yet. And it definitely helped me to learn as much as I could about this diagnosis. That is very often, I think the information that we have today is very often outdated and it's very misunderstood. It's a very complex diagnosis. But I was also very lucky to meet the right doctors and to find a fitting treatment. And of course, there are different cases and there are also severe cases. But there are also many people out there who live with this diagnosis and they are not, they have very normal lives. So it is not affecting my my daily life. It is not affecting my professional life. And because of this treatment, I've been episode and symptom free since my diagnosis. So, I've been also very lucky.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that. And long may that continue. And it does, as you say, gives hope to people maybe when they do get a tough diagnosis, be it MS or be it anything else, that there may be light at the end of that tunnel, and maybe keep the hope alive for that. Alice, thanks so much for speaking to us this evening, and I'll give people details of your National Concert Hall, where there is a room actually called the John Field Room. You'll have to go in and play a nocturne just for yourself if nobody else.
It's true. Yes, it's true. No, I'm very much looking forward to coming to Ireland and to Dublin and to the hometown of John Field.
Thanks very much, Alice, and stay well. That's Alice Sarah Ott. She will be at the National Concert Hall February the 27th. More details on nch.ie, and her album John Field Complete Nocturnes will be released tomorrow. And I'm going off to check out the videos that go with the various nocturnes to see what visual delights she has added to them.